Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. The MSS crew is back and thanking you for once again joining us here in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room of RadioOutOfThePast.org. Today's date is Saturday, November 5th, 2016, and this is Luis Jr., your host, assisting with bringing to you yet another installment of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. Our presenter tonight will be Rotten Rick Spurgeon. So if everyone could just please sit back, grab your favorite drinks and snacks, and enjoy the program. Rotten Rick, the microphone is yours.
I love to listen to my radio. Gee, how it thrills me when I hear it go.
Morning, kiddies.
That's when I think of you. When shadows fall at the close of the day, I turn on the switch and it starts into play.
Tim comes in with a jab to the head, a hook to the jaw, and a smash to the nose.
Hey again, group, and thanks, Luis. Here we are. Oop, it's my turn. Tonight, we're going to have three shows. As usual, the Baxters will be our climax. But before then, we're going to have a couple of one-man shows. Shows that were done by one man. Now, that's logical. Even I could figure that part out. We'll start with a show from 1946. Early in this chap's career, it's a reality-based show in that the root of it, the chap who does this is, well, he requires no introduction, because if you don't know his identity in the first 5 seconds, then you've been faking being an OTR fan. This is a series called One Out of Seven. Not a very long series. And this is an example of someone doing multiple voices. Not a bad show, actually. I don't think it's world class, and he went on to better things afterwards, but give this a listen. It gives you a chance to hear some versatility in an actor.
Ladies and gentlemen, the material and quotations used on the following program are taken from authentic news reports off the wires of Associated Press and International News Service. We present this material without editorial comment, since this station takes no official stand on any controversial question. We can, therefore, assume no responsibility for the attitude such statements reflect.
From San Francisco, the American Broadcasting Company presents One Out of Seven. Twenty-four hours make a day, 7 days make 1 week. And from these past 7 days, the editors here in our San Francisco newsroom have chosen the one story which they have judged most worthy of retelling. This is One Out of Seven.
We're not here to tell you what is good or what is evil, or to tell you what is right and what is not right. Being only men as you are, and thus being as moral or as immoral as you are, we refuse to mount the seat of judgment to pass sentence on those as guilty or as innocent as we claim ourselves to be. Now, we ask only that you pause, observe, and reflect. You have an intelligence of your own. Judge these actions for yourself. Last week, beneath the spacious skies of America the Beautiful, in the valleys of the amber grain and the fruited plain, and in the city towers looming high with the majesty of purple mountains, the people rejoiced and rededicated themselves in a nationwide Brotherhood Week. Lofty and ideal were the speeches of Brotherhood Week. Stirring and altruistic were the pledges and promises of Brotherhood Week. Godly and charitable were the aims of Brotherhood Week. But there are two families in San Francisco who are asking questions. Two families. City desk, Martin.
Say, boss, here's a pretty fair yarn on an eviction case. You want it?
Yeah, sure. What's it all about?
Well, it seems there's a gentleman out in one of the residential districts who objects to the presence of a Filipino family in the neighborhood. There's also a Chinese family living nearby that, well, it doesn't appeal to him either.
Yeah, I'll go on.
Well, this gentleman says that the fact that these two families are living near him detracts from the value of his property.
Well, what's the matter? Does he have something against them?
Oh, no, nothing like that, boss. He just says that when he moved there, he was told that it was a neighborhood for white people. White people only. One of those restricted deals, you know? Well, now he's filing suit to have him evicted. Says he's losing money if they stay.
What about the two families? What have they got to say?
Well, they're plenty burned up about it. They're organizing, yeah, to fight the neighbor boosters club who's behind this gentleman. One of the members of the Filipino family is, well, he's a Navy veteran, and he gave me a pretty good quote.
Well, go ahead. Let's have it.
Okay, boss. He says, is this what we've been fighting for? To have a bunch of stay-at-homes throw us out of our house?
No, we're not here to tell you what is right and what is wrong. We wish merely to report that last week, the nation observed Brotherhood Week. In the churches and town halls throughout the country, the people rededicated themselves to the principles of tolerance and charity of the founding fathers. Columbia, Tennessee. A little more than 24 hours ago, the worst racial disorder in years, brought about by rumors of threatened lynching of Negroes, sweeps the city. 500 highway patrolmen raid a two-block area in the Negro section of the town where the non-white are carefully segregated. Armed with pistols and machine guns, the huge force of police search every Negro building in the area. Under the command of the State Director of Public Safety, the patrolmen fire withering blasts through the windows of the homes of the buildings. Groups of the Negroes huddled behind barricaded doors answer the machine gun fire with two or three scattered shots. More than 40 Negroes are arrested during the raid. The State Director of Public Safety describes the police exploit as a success. The origin of the bloody race riot is not clear, but it is reported that it started when a Negro woman and her son had a fight with a Navy veteran. The Negro couple were arrested, and it was then, according to one Negro, that the lynching rumor fired the town. Isn't that right?
Well, we heard that the white men were going to have a lynching party tonight, and, well, we didn't like that. We didn't want any killing to start again.
And so, brethren, let us again renew our faith in Christian charity, in the principles of brotherhood that Christ himself handed down to us. And let us again resolve to act and live by the precept that we are all brothers, regardless of the color of our skin or the creed we profess, that we are all brothers in the house of the Lord.
Here to pass judgment on what is good and what is evil. We wish merely to report that last week, in a nationwide celebration marked by pledge and promise, the people observed the annual custom of Brotherhood Week. In a large eastern city, time, Thursday of last week, a Jewish newspaper editor and his family stand outside their burning home, huddled in firemen's capes against the cold of the early winter morning. I'm from headquarters, Mr. Byrne. I heard about how the fire started in your house. Do you expect anybody or suspect anybody in particular?
Well, you know, I could not tell you the name of the man. I don't think I know him. But lately I've been receiving phone calls and a few letters, too, warning me about the editorials I've been writing in my district newspaper.
Well, what were those phone calls and letters all about, Mr. Burnt?
Well, they said I was trying to make our district into a ghetto and a Negro colony because I've been opposing a drive by the neighborhood club to keep out all the Jews, Negroes, Italians, Chinese. I think, you know, officer, you must have heard.
Yeah, I've heard, Mr. Burnt. I guess this is their answer, huh?
Yes. Tonight, there was another telephone call, and then about 1 o'clock, my wife and I were...
torches and let them fly. We'll teach that Jew a lesson he won't forget. Come on, let's get out of here.
You see, it is not our place to pass sentence on the incident, for we're only men as moral or as immoral as you are, or as they are. We wish only to point out that last week was Brotherhood Week. Several appropriate speeches were made, and the people as a whole pledged themselves to tolerance and charity. The annual observance was acclaimed a success. Throughout the nation, priests and ministers... This is a story which probably will not receive the circulation it deserves. It concerns an incident which occurred last week at a southeastern Navy station here in the United States. And if my guess is right, it should give many a citizen cause to stop and ponder the worth and aims of our lately won victory. It all happened in one of the mess rooms at this particular Navy base where a group of officers...
Now, look, I don't care what anybody says. It's all the fault of the Jews. Now, look, I was in the Pacific, yeah. And all the time we're sweating it out over there, the big Jews back in the States are demanding that we defeat Germany first while the men in the Pacific starve and sweat it out. Now, oh, no, no, you can't tell me a thing about those Jews, brother. I know exactly what they're like. You can have them.
I beg your pardon, Commander. I'm a Jew, and I think you're very mistaken in what you say.
Well, now, listen here, Mr. Goldstein. You're a lieutenant. The Constitution may say that I have to serve in the same Navy with Jews, but there are no Navy regulations that say I have to eat at the same table with them.
Now, you other gentlemen will excuse me. Last week was Brotherhood Week. Last week was Brotherhood Week. Down through the rain, down through the wet, glistening street he came, his head bared, his frayed coat collar pulled tightly around his neck, a wide, ugly cut on his forehead, still bleeding, a monstrous bruise covering the side of his face. But strangely, I noticed he walked straight up, his head high. Came up and he stood beside me at the bus stop. And after a while he said,
You are wondering about me. Is that not so? This cut on my head and this bruise on my face?
Why, yes, as a matter of fact, I was wondering about...
Yeah, well...
Well, it looks like a pretty nasty cut, mister. Tell me, how'd you get it?
Well, it all happened so suddenly, I still cannot remember everything. I try. Tonight, like every Wednesday night, we have our meeting down in the hall on the west side of the city, you know?
Yeah, I know where that hall is.
Well, on Wednesdays, the people who are of my race, well, we all meet together to learn about our new country, to study the language, and to try to be better Americans.
Uh-huh.
But tonight, we have some visitors. They are a group of men, and they say... We cannot stay here because this town is for people of their race only. We say we will not go. And then there is a big fight. The men wreck our club room. They smash our furniture. And they fight with us. They tell us in loud voices, get out, stay out. But we fight back because we know the laws. The laws say these men are wrong. Oh, but the laws, they are not everything. Are they?
Well, no, they're not, mister. You'll find that out.
Yes, we have found it out already. There are many things different about America than first I thought. Well, now, I must cross the street to the church. Would you like to come with me? I do not pray, you know, but I like to stand there in the church and say these things. It makes me feel better inside here after what has happened tonight.
I crossed the street with him and I went into the church.
We sat down in one of the pews far back in one of the dark corners of the church. A few candles flickered uncertainly up at the altar, and after a long moment he turned to me and he said,
I do not hate these men who do such things. I am not bitter against them. Only I have so much pity for them. For is it not true? They are like frightened little children, afraid, running around, looking for an enemy to fight. Anybody. But they do not see. The real enemy, he is inside them. Oh, they hate us. Yes, they hate us. But really, they do not know why. They would kill us. And then they would look down at our bodies, and they would feel like little children who had just broken their toys. They see only the difference of color or language. And they become angry because we are not as they. Oh, it is so sad. And that is why I have so much pity for them. So blind. They are so blind. The sun is there waiting for them, shining warm and full over everybody. But their eyes are still closed, and all they can see is the darkness.
Script for 1 out of 7 is written by James Edward Moser. Gil Dowd is the producer, and music is by Otto Clare at the Hammond organ. All characters in tonight's performance were portrayed by Jack Webb. Listen next week, same time, same station, for 1 out of 7. Mark Jordan speaking. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
Well, I don't think he did too bad a job of multi-voices. It wasn't sparkling necessarily, but really what made the program work was its content and the overall presentation. You really had to think when you heard this one. And it's still a current topic. If you look at what's on the news these days, we really haven't progressed all that much in some ways in terms of brotherhood. The next program is really the reason why I'm doing this whole idea of one-man shows. I was reading an article the other night about Nelson Olmsted and Sleep No More. Now, Sleep No More is one of those small series that came out in 1956, the time when some people say radio was dying and others say it was going through some innovations, and probably both are true. It's a short-lived program, and because I read the article, I thought maybe it's time I listened to one of them. And I was really surprised. I think this show ranks up just about as well as Suspense. Again, one man doing all the voices, or at least all the characters. He really doesn't do the voices. This is one thing that makes it different. He doesn't try to pretend he's a female in certain parts, but he presents the dialogue in a way that you don't have any indication that there's nobody there but who should be there. Gives a listen. I think this is, if it works for you the same way I did, one of those programs that you're going to be on the edge of your seat. So watch where you put your feet.
In just a moment, Sleep No More, but first...
Hello? Oh, hello, Martha. No, just finishing my housework and enjoying NBC Bandstand on the radio. Oh, it's just fabulous. This week they have Freddie Martin and his orchestra, Burt Parks, of course, and Snooky Lanson as the singing star, and the Glenn Miller Orchestra under the direction of Ray McKinley. But why am I telling you about it? Tune it in yourself.
NBC Bandstand, live weekday mornings on NBC Radio.
And now stay tuned for Sleep No More on NBC.
This is Nelson Olmsted. Sleep No More. Sleep no more. Turn down the lights. Sink back in your chair and don't look into the shadows. In the shadows, there may be moving things. Tonight, it may be, you will sleep no more.
Good evening. This is Ben Grauer introducing tonight's tale of terror, told by Nelson Olmsted on the National Broadcasting Company's presentation of Sleep No More. The story of terror can be as simple as a sheeted ghost rattling chains. It can be a complex and hidden world of horror, lurking in such unholy dimensions as only the dead and the moonstruck can glimpse. Or it can be those terrible, fathomless shadows which lie buried deep in the primitive mind of civilized man. And for this evening, well, Nelson Olmsted, tell us about this evening's story.
Well, Ben, it's called 3 o'clock, and it's a masterly chiller by William Irish. When a man is jealous and when that same man has long had the urge to kill, well,
then you have 3 o'clock by William Irish, is that it?
That's it, Ben.
So, Nelson Olmsted, tell us about this man.
She had signed her own death warrant. He kept telling himself over and over that he wasn't to blame. She'd brought it on herself. He had never seen the man, but he knew there was one. He had known for 6 weeks now. One day he came home, and there was a cigar butt in an ashtray, still moist at one end, still warm at the other. His wife was too often flustered when he came home, hardly seemed to know what she was doing or saying at all. He pretended not to see any of these things. He was that type of man, Stapp was. He didn't bring his hates or grudges out into the open where they had a chance to heal. He nursed them in the darkness of his mind. That's a dangerous kind of man. If he'd been honest with himself, he would have had to admit that this mysterious afternoon caller was just the excuse he gave himself, that he daydreamed of getting rid of his wife long before there was any reason to, that there had been something in him for years past now urging, kill, 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 maybe ever since that time he'd been treated at the hospital for a concussion. He didn't have any of the usual excuses. She had no money of her own. He hadn't insured her. He stood to gain nothing by getting rid of her. She didn't nag and quarrel with him. She was a docile, tractable sort of wife. But this thing in his brain kept whispering, kill, kill, kill. So every afternoon, for 6 weeks now, when he came home from his shop, he had brought little things with him, very little things that were so harmless, so inoffensive in themselves, that no one, even if they'd seen them, could have guessed. Fine little strands of copper wire, such as he sometimes used in his watch repairing. And each time, a very little package containing a substance that, well, an explosives expert might have recognized, but no one else. Loose like that, it couldn't hurt you. But wadded tightly into cells in what had formerly been a soapbox down in the basement, compressed to within an inch of its life the way he had it, the whole accumulated 36 days worth of it, that would be a different story. They'd never know. There wouldn't be enough left of the flimsy house for them to go by. Sewer gas explosion, they'd think, or a pocket of natural gas in the ground somewhere around under them. He'd be in his shop, tinkering with his watch parts, and the phone would ring. Mr. Stapp! Mr. Stapp! Your house has just been demolished by a blast! The last little package had been brought in 2 days ago. The box had all it could hold now, twice as much as was necessary to blow up the house. The box was set, the wires were in place, the batteries that would give off the necessary spark were attached. All that was necessary now was to hook up the clock, and then today was the day. At 12:30 sharp, he wrapped up the alarm clock he'd been working on, tucked it under his arm, and left the shop. He took the bus, got off at his usual stop, walked 3 interminable suburban blocks to his house, and let himself in. She wasn't home, of course, as he knew. She was out marketing, as usual. He went directly to the door leading to the basement. He passed through it, closed it behind him, and went down the bare wooden steps to the basement floor. She hadn't even known that he'd come down here each night for a few minutes while she was in the kitchen doing the dishes. By the time she got through, he was upstairs again behind his newspaper. It didn't take long to add the contents of each successive little package to what was already in the box. The wiring had taken more time, but he'd gotten that done one night when she'd gone out to the movies. Or so she'd said. The little box, that was no longer merely a box now, but an infernal machine, was standing over against the wall to one side of the oil burner. He was proud of it, prouder than of any fine watch he'd ever repaired or reconstructed. He unwrapped the clock and spread out the few necessary small implements he'd brought with him from the shop. Two fine copper wires were sticking stiffly out of a small hole he'd bored in the box, in readiness, like the antenna of some kind of insect. Through them, death would go in. He wound the clock up first, for he couldn't safely do that once it was connected. He wound it up to within an inch of its life. He set the alarm for 3, but there was a difference now. Instead of just setting off a harmless bell when the hour hand reached 3 and the minute hand reached 12, the wires attached to it, leading to the batteries, would set off a spark. A single, tiny, evanescent spark. That was all. He wondered why more people didn't do things like this. They didn't know what they were missing. Probably not clever enough to be able to make the things themselves, that was why. He set the clock itself by his own pocket watch, 1:15. Then he carefully guided the antenna-like wires leading from the box through a hole previously bored in the back of the clock and fastened them to the necessary parts of the mechanism. It was highly dangerous, but his hands didn't play him false. And when he'd done with it, it stood there on the floor as if placed there at random up against an innocent-looking copper-lidded soapbox ticking away. 10 minutes had gone by since he'd come down here. 1 hour and 40 minutes were still to go by. Death was on the wing. He smiled a little and went on up the stairs, not furtively or fearfully, but like a man does in his own house, with an unhurried air of ownership, head up, shoulders back, tread firm. As he opened the basement door and stepped out into the ground floor hall, someone jumped on him, caught him brutally by the throat with one hand, flung him back against the wall and pinned him there. And then the man struck out at him, hit him a stunning blow on the side of the head with his free hand. Stapp's senses dulled into a whirling flux for a minute. And before they had cleared, a second man had leaped down from up the stairs from one of the rooms above, and he said, "Hurry up! Get something to tie him up with, and let's get out of here!" "Oh, good Lord, don't tie..." Stapp tried to say, clawing at his own throat to free it. He wasn't fighting the man off. He was only trying to tear that throttling impediment off long enough to get out what he had to tell him. But his assailant couldn't tell the difference. He struck him savagely a second time and a third time, and Stapp went limp there against the wall without altogether losing consciousness. The second one had come back already with a rope that looked like Fran's clothesline. Stapp was dimly aware of this rope going around and around him, crisscross, in and out, legs and body and arms. "Don't," he panted. And his mouth was suddenly nearly torn in two as a large handkerchief or rag was thrust in, effectively silencing all further sound. Then they whipped something around outside of that to keep it in and fastened it behind his head. And one of the men asked,
"Where'll we put him?"
"Well, leave him where he is."
"No, I did my last stretch just in account of leaving the guy in the open. Let's shove him back down where he was."
Well, this brought on a new spasm, almost epileptic in its violence. He squirmed and writhed and shook his head back and forth. They had picked him up between them now, head and feet, kicked the basement door open, and were carrying him down the steps to the bottom. They still couldn't be made to understand that he wasn't resisting, that he wouldn't call the police, that he wouldn't lift a finger to have them apprehended if they'd only let him out of here with them. They deposited him on the floor by the pipe in the corner and lashed him in a sitting position there with an added length of rope that had been coiled in the basement. As the men left, one of them turned back and said,
"Take it easy, bud. Relax. I used to be a sailor. You never get out of them knots."
Stapp swiveled his skull desperately, threw his eyes at the clock one last time, and then, with the horrible slowness of a nightmare, the man turned and went out through the doorway. The basement door ebbed back into its socket with a minor click that to him was like the crack of doom. In the silence now, above the surge of his own tidal breathing that came and went like surf upon a shoreline, was the counterpoint of the clock. With the men went his only link with the outside world. They were the only two people in the whole city who knew where he was at this moment. No one else, not a living soul, knew where to find him. Now what would happen to him if he wasn't found and gotten out of here by 3 o'clock?
It was 25 to 2 now, and the clock was ticking so rhythmically, so remorselessly, so fast. Then, at 4 to 2, a door opened above without warning. Oh, blessed sound. Oh, lovely sound. The front door this time, and high-heeled shoes clacked over his head like castanets. Fran, he shouted. Fran, he yelled. Fran, he screamed. But all that got past the gag was a low whimper that didn't even reach across the basement. His face was wet and dark with the effort it cost him, and a cord stood out at each side of his palpitating neck like a splint. The tap, tap, tap went into the kitchen, stopped a minute. She was putting down her parcels, and came back again. If only there was something he could kick at with his interlocked feet, make a clatter with. He tried hoisting his lashed legs clear of the floor and pounding them down again with all his might. Maybe the sound of the impact would carry up to her. All he got was a soft cushion sound with twice the pain of striking a stone surface with your bare palm. An electrical discharge of pain shot up the back of his legs, coursed up his spine, and exploded at the back of his head like a brilliant rocket. Meanwhile, her steps had halted about where the hall closet was, and then she went on toward the stairs that led to the upper floor, faded out upon them, going up. She was out of earshot now, temporarily. But she was in the house with him, at least. That awful aloneness was gone. He felt such gratitude for her nearness. He felt such love and need for her. He wondered how he could ever have thought of doing away with her only one short hour ago. He saw now that he must have been insane to contemplate such a thing. Five after. She'd been back 9 minutes now. And then it was 10. At first slowly and then faster and faster, terror, which had momentarily been quelled by her return, began to fasten upon him again. Why did she stay up there on the second floor like that? Why didn't she come down here to the basement and look for something? Well, she might intend to stay up there all afternoon. 11 past 2. 49 minutes left. No, not just minutes left. It wasn't fair. Fran, he shrieked. Fran, come down here. Can't you hear me? The gag absorbed his shrieks like a sponge. The phone trilled out suddenly in the lower hallway, midway between him and her. He'd never heard such a beautiful sound before. A tear stood out in each eye. Well, that must be the man now. That would bring her down. And then he heard her quick step descending the stairs to answer it. He could hear every word she said down there where he was, from all these cheap matchwood houses.
Hello? Oh, yes, Dave, I just got in now.
And then?
Oh, Dave, I'm all upset. I had $17 upstairs in my bureau drawer, and it's gone, and the wristwatch that Paul gave me is gone, too. It looks to me as if someone broke in here while I was out and robbed us.
Stapp almost writhed with delight. She knew they'd been robbed. She'd get the police now. Surely they'd search the whole place. Surely they'd look down here and find him. And then she said,
no, I haven't reported it yet. I suppose I should, but I don't like the idea. On your account, you know. No, I'm going to call up Paul at the shop. There's just a chance that he took the money and the watch with him when he left this morning. You come out then, Dave.
There was a pause while she broke the connection. Then he heard her dial his shop number and wait while they were ringing. Of course, no one answered. In terrible silence, he screamed,
I'm right here under your feet. Don't waste time. For heaven's sakes, come down here.
Finally, she hung up, and he heard her going up the stairs again, and he whimpered disappointedly. 1/2 hour and 9 scant minutes more left, and they ticked away with the prodigality of tropical raindrops on a corrugated tin roof. He kept straining and pulling away from the pipe that held him fast, and then falling back exhausted to rest a while, to struggle and to strain some more. How could ropes hold that unyieldingly? Each time he felt back weaker, less able to contend with them than the time before. For he wasn't little strands of hemp. He was layers of thin skin that broke one by one and gave forth burning pain and finally blood. The doorbell rang out sharply. The man had come.
Stapp's chest started rising and falling with renewed hope. Four ears instead of two to hear whatever slight sound he might manage to make. And he must find a way of making one. Oh, thank God for this admirer, or whatever he was. Thank God for their rendezvous. She came quickly down the stairs a second time, and her footfalls hurried down the hall. The front door opened.
Hello, Dave,
he heard her say, and a man's voice asked,
did it turn up yet?
No, and I've looked high and low. Now, I tried to get Paul after I spoke to you, but he was out to lunch. Come in the kitchen. I'll make you a cup of coffee.
Her quick, brittle step went first, and his heavier, slower one followed. There was the sound of a couple of chairs being drawn out, and the man's footfalls died out entirely. Hers continued busily back and forth for a while on a short orbit between stove and table. What were they going to do? Sit there for the next half hour? Couldn't he make them hear him in some way? He tried clearing his throat, coughing. It hurt furiously, and the gag muffled even the cough to a blurred, purring sort of sound. 26 to 3, only minutes left now. Minutes, not even a full half hour anymore. And then he heard her say,
don't you think we ought to tell Paul about us?
Well, what kind of a guy is he?
Well, Paul's not narrow-minded. He's very fair and broad. Well, you have nothing to be afraid of in Paul's account, Dave.
Didn't you ever tell him about me at all?
You mean the beginning? Oh, I told him you'd been in one or two scrapes, but like a little fool, I let him think I'd lost track of you and didn't know where you were anymore.
Why, that was her brother she'd said that about. The man sitting up there with her confirmed it right as the thought burst in his mind.
Yeah. I know it's tough on you, sis. You're happily married and all that. Yeah, I got no right to come around and gum things up for you. No one's proud of a jailbird and escaped convict for a brother. Yeah, I suppose I'll have to go back and finish it out, but 7 years, old friend. 7 years out of a man's life.
David, there isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. But before you decide anything, let's go downtown and talk it over with Paul and hear what he says.
One chair jarred back, and then the other. He could hear dishes clatter, as though they'd all been lumped together in one stack. What, were they going to leave again? Were they going to leave him behind here, alone, with only minutes to spare? Their footsteps went down the hall. Stay with me, Stapp wailed. Stay! Panic-stricken, Stapp did the only thing he could think of. Struck the back of his head violently against the thick pipe he was attached to. A sheet of blue flame darted before his eyes. The pain was so excruciating, he knew he couldn't repeat the attempt. But they must have heard something. Some dull thud or reverberation must have carried up along the pipe. He heard her stop short for a minute and say,
what was that?
The man said he hadn't heard anything, and she took his word for it. And there was the sound of the front door opening. She passed through it. The man passed through it. It closed. They were gone. He was left alone with his self-fashioned doom a second time, and the first seemed a paradise in retrospect compared to this, for then he had a full hour to spare. He'd been rich in time, and now he only had 15 minutes, one miserly quarter hour. Well, there wasn't any use struggling anymore. He couldn't anyway, even if he wanted to. Flames seemed to be licking lazily around his wrists and ankles. He'd found a sort of palliative now, the only way there was left. He'd keep his eyes down and pretend the hands were moving slower than they were. It was better than watching them constantly. It blunted a little of the terror, at least. The ticking, he couldn't hide from. Of course, every once in a while, when he couldn't resist looking up and verifying his own calculations, there'd be a renewed burst of anguish. But in between times, it made it more bearable to say, it's only gained a half minute since the last time I looked. Then, suddenly, the outside world intruded again. The doorbell rang out. He took no hope from the summons at first. Maybe it was some peddler. Came again. Whoever was ringing was truculently impatient at being kept waiting. A third ring was given the bell, this time a veritable blast that kept on for nearly half a minute. And then as the peal finally stopped, a voice called out forcefully,
anybody home in there?
Gas company.
And suddenly Stapp was quivering all over. This was the one call, the one incident in all the day's domestic routine from earliest morning until latest night that could possibly have brought anyone down into the basement. The meter was up there in the wall, staring him in the face. And her brother had had to take her out of the house at just this particular time. There was no one to let the man in. The gas inspector gave the bell one more try, as if venting his disappointment of being balked, rather than in any expectation of being admitted at this late time in the proceedings. He gave it innumerable short jabs, like a telegraph key, and then he called out disgustedly, evidently for the benefit of some unseen assistant waiting in a truck out at the curb.
They're never in when you want them to be.
There was a single quick tread on the cement, away from the house. Stapp died a little. His arms and legs got cold up to the elbows and knees. His heart seemed to beat slower, and he had trouble getting a full breath. Saliva escaped and ran down his chin, and his head drooped forward and lay in his chest for a while, inert. The clock ticked on. He noticed that his mind was starting to wander. Suddenly, the outer world returned again. This time it was the phone. It must be Fran and her brother trying to find out if he'd come back here in their absence. They'd found the shop closed, must have waited outside it for a while, and when he still didn't come, they didn't know what to make of it. And when no one answered, that would tell him, surely, that something was wrong. Wouldn't they come back now to find out what had happened to him? But how could they dream he was in the basement the whole time? Why should they think he was here in the house if he didn't answer the phone? Fran would become real worried. Maybe they'd go to the police. But that would be hours from now. What good would that do? They'd look everywhere but here for him. When a man is reported missing, the last place they'd look for him would be in his own home. It stopped ringing finally, and silence came rolling back in its wake. 3:09. Oh, what a lovely number was 9. Let it be 9 forever, not 8 or 7. 9 for all eternity. Make time stand still. But no, it was already 8. Oh, what a precious number was 8, so rounded, so symmetrical. Let it be 8 forever. A woman's voice called out in sharp reprimand somewhere outside in the open.
Bobby, be careful what you're doing. You'll break that window.
She was some distance away, but the ringing dictatorial tones carried clearly. And suddenly Stapp saw the blurred shape of a ball strike the basement transom. A child came close up against the transom to get its ball back. If it would only turn its head over this way, it could look right in. It could see him. The glass wasn't too smeary for that. Stapp started to weave his head violently from side to side, hoping the flurry of motion would attract it and catch its eye. Suddenly, it had turned its head and was looking directly in through the transom. And then it saw him, and it yelled,
Mommy, look!
An adult hand suddenly darted downward from the upper right-hand corner of the transom, caught the child's wrist, bore its arm upward out of sight. But it pointed and said,
Mommy, funny man tied up, look!
The adult voice, reasonable, logical, dispassionate, answered,
Why, that wouldn't look nice. Mommy can't peer into other people's houses like you can.
The child's head disappeared above the transom. Its body was pivoted around away from him. He could see the hollows at the back of its knees for an instant longer, and then its outline on the glass blurred in withdrawal. It was gone. Only the little clear spot it had scoured remained to mock him in his crucifixion. He rolled his head away from the window, back toward the clock finally. To his horror, it stood at 3:03. He couldn't feel anymore. Terror or hope or anything else, a sort of numbness set in, with a core of gleaming awareness remaining that was in his mind. He was making animal noises deep in his throat as the minute hand slowly blended with the notch of 12. Guttural sounds like a dog worrying about a bone, though the gag prevented the sounds from emerging in full volume. He puckered the flesh around his eyes apprehensively, creasing them into slits, as though the closing of his eyes could ward off, lessen the terrific force of what was to come. The hand on the dial gradually became upright. It was 3:00, but he didn't know it. He was shaking all over from head to foot, not with fear, but with laughter. And then everything went black. Thank you. What's the matter with him, officer? What's the matter with him? It was Fran, and she was standing over him crying. The policeman was untying the hard, knotted ropes and taking the gag out of his mouth. The officer felt his pulse, and then he said,
"Well, he must have passed out, ma'am. But I think he'll be all right. We better get him to a hospital, though."
The clock said 7:05. The cop got up, went over to the box, and kicked it idly with his foot. It shifted lightly along the wall a little and took the clock with it. And he asked,
"What's in this box?"
And Stapp's wife looked at it and answered, "Nothing. Well, it used to have some kind of fertilizer in it, but only this morning I took it out and emptied it in the flowers I've been trying to raise in the back of the house. It's just an empty box."
Can turn up the lights now. You can look around you. Nobody is there, really. Everything is all right, isn't it? Step over here, Nelson Olmsted, and tell us about next week's story.
Next week's story on Sleep No More is about a woman in a large, empty house which the wind buffets and shakes. And in that house, the woman finds a pinpoint of light where there should be no light. The story is The Storm by McKnight Melmar.
You have been listening to Sleep No More, an NBC Radio Network production directed by Kenneth McGregor. Mr. Olmsted's albums are recorded exclusively for Vanguard Records. Until next week, when Nelson Olmsted will again be here in person, this is Ben Grauer bidding you good night.
Well, I stand to be corrected by you experts who do a lot of talking book reading and are probably much better judges of narration than I am. But to me, the way he handled inflections and the small nuances of speech really made this thing work. If you think the same thing, I'll be quite happy to do more of these. Well, the other thing I was thinking too is, the one small negative to me personally was, I thought it was just a slightly bit anticlimactic. It was an appropriate climax, I suppose, but I just think it kind of fell a little short after the big build-up. There could have been something more to it. Don't know what it was, so I guess I shouldn't criticize. So we've been to the 40s, into the 50s, now into the 70s for Peg and Bob. And this is one of those deals that most of us run into where there's a little conflict between neighbors. One thing you might want to listen to here is Peg's suggestion on how to solve it. They didn't use it, but it's an interesting thought. "Shall we go?" he said, pushing the button. And they said, "Shut up and let me hear it."
It's not nice to eavesdrop, but it's fun. So let's check in on the comedy of errors at the Baxters. On The Little Things in Life, brought to you by Final Net, gives your hair a great long-lasting hold.
Hi, Fred. Come on in, neighbor.
Hi. Where's your Lord Master?
Oh, he'll be right down. I told him dinner was ready. He's taking a shower. He played tennis with Bill Fraley after work.
He did?
Mm-hmm.
Asked him to play last week, and he said he'd forgotten how. It's been so long.
Oh, it has been. Well, if you mentioned tennis, I guess he got interested again. Have a cookie. I just baked him.
He said he didn't even have a racket.
No, he didn't. He went out and bought one on his lunch hour, I guess.
He asked me to go with him when he bought a racket, since tennis is my hobby.
Well, I don't know, Fred. It all happened so suddenly, I guess. After all, Bill's in the same office, and I suppose they got to talking about tennis.
So he goes out and plays with Bill Fraley, huh?
Well, I guess it was just one of those impulses.
Oh, I don't care. I just think it's kind of funny, that's all.
Well,
listen, if he doesn't want to play tennis with me, I don't care.
Fred,
doesn't make...
Now, for goodness sake, you're so good at it, he probably just wanted to brush up a little so you wouldn't be too bored playing with him, you know.
Yeah? Well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, I don't have to wait until he's out of the shower. I just came over to get the extension ladder.
Oh, sure, it's in the garage, usual place. Help yourself.
Thanks.
Excuse me, can I get into the cupboard here?
Oh, sure. I'm fine. About the ladder.
Take it. You can borrow it. He's not going to be using it tonight. I know it's all right.
Well, actually...
No, Fred, take it. I know it's all right for you to borrow it. Good heavens. It's over at your place half the time, anyhow.
What does that mean?
Oh, nothing, Fred. I just meant the ladder goes back and forth so much it doesn't matter. Take it, for goodness sakes. You don't even need to ask.
Yeah, well, that's the point. I don't have to ask because, as a matter of fact, it's my ladder.
What?
It's my ladder, it is. I'm the guy that bought it.
That's your ladder, Fred?
Look, it's not important. It's just that when you said I could borrow it, that I didn't even need to ask, but I thought I would mention that it is my ladder, that's all. Let's not make a big thing of it, okay?
Well,
I don't mind your borrowing it, okay?
Look,
just tell your old man I'm taking it home, okay?
Well, wait a minute. Fred? Wait a minute. I think I hear him coming downstairs now. Maybe you two ought to talk about the deer. Dear Fred's deer.
Nothing to talk about. I'll just get my ladder.
Hey, you running the hot water? I couldn't get any in the shower. There I stood, all soaped up, and then suddenly the water dribbles off to a trickle.
No, I'm sorry, dear. Yes, I washed up some baking dishes, I'm afraid.
Well, you knew I was taking a shower.
I forgot. Can't you get somebody to do something about the pipes or whatever? It's very inconvenient not to be able to get hot water upstairs if somebody's running something down here. People are always getting trapped in a waterless shower.
I don't know. I'll probably have to have the water pressure checked again. The house probably needs all new pipes, which we certainly cannot afford right now.
Well, I know.
Hey, wait a minute. There goes Fred taking our ladder again.
Well, he was just here. Oh, you know what he said?
No, how would I know? I was upstairs taking a shower, or trying to take a shower.
All right, if you don't want to hear what Fred said, I'm in. Dinner is ready, so...
No, what did Fred say?
He said when I said he could borrow the ladder that he didn't even need to ask, he said he knew he didn't because actually he said it's his ladder. That's
what his ladder?
That's what he said. I said, why no, Fred? I'm sure we bought that ladder.
Well, we did. I did.
And I know. I said, didn't his ladder get run over by a truck or something in his driveway?
Yeah, right. Years ago, shortly after we moved in.
Yes, in fact, isn't that how we met Fred? Didn't he come over here and ask if we had a big ladder he could borrow?
Yes.
No. The first time we met him, he came over to borrow something else. Lawnmower. Power drill? Something.
No, just name it and you'll be right. Always borrowing something.
Well, now, dear, you like Fred. He's a good friend. Actually, he's a little upset, I think, because you played tennis today with Bill Fraley.
Well, I just mentioned it this noon to Bill Fraley, and he said, let's go out and buy you a racket on our lunch hour and play after work.
That's what I thought.
You know, people who get their feelings hurt over every darn thing are really pains in the neck.
Well, yeah, but look, Evie is a good friend of mine. Now, you try to get along with Fred. Suggest playing tennis with him this weekend.
Okay, but I'm going to get this ladder thing settled.
Well,
this is definitely our ladder.
That is true. Well, let's eat dinner anyhow. We're having lamb patties, and they get cold and tallowy so fast.
Look at him out there, carting off my ladder.
Can we eat?
Fred!
Oh, don't start something now, honey. Dinner is all ready.
What's all this about the ladder being yours?
Can't you two talk
it
about this after dinner?
It just happens to be mine. Well, that's crazy. I bought that ladder before we even moved out here.
Look, dinner is ready. There are times when you and Fred act like 9-year-olds. Now, let's eat. Where are you going, dear?
To the attic.
Dinner will be stone cold.
I'm going to look up our old bills. I know darn well I bought that ladder at Casson Hardware before we even moved out here to the village. I know darn well it's mine.
You going to break up a friendship over a silly ladder?
It's the principle of the thing. I know that ladder is mine, and I'm going to prove it. Threw them out? You threw them out?
Yes, I did when I cleaned the attic. I saw shoebox after shoebox of old bills and invoices, 10, 15 years old, and I thought, why are we saving all this junk?
Well, now, you know why.
Well, dear.
Every single time you go on one of your throwing out sprees, the next day, that's the very thing we want.
Well, I have to admit that's true. But I did not throw out the canceled checks, and I keep those downstairs here in the old desk in the den. Now, let me look. Have you any idea when you think you bought the ladder?
Well, I don't think I bought it. I know I bought it.
All right. When?
I remember. You had fallen off that rickety kitchen stool and sprained your ankle, and I said you needed a decent step stool. And when I bought you one, I also bought the big extension ladder. Now, let's think back. When would that have been?
November 25th, 1964.
What? How can you possibly remember
that? Very simple. It's my birthday. That's when it happened.
Right. I forgot that was your birthday.
Yeah, well, you usually do. Look in that box. 1964, November.
June, July, September.
Dear.
October.
Aye.
November. Here we are.
Listen, wouldn't it be better if you did not make an issue out of this?
November 1964. Yeah. Here we are. Casson Hardware.
Yeah, listen.
4267. I didn't know the extension ladder cost that much, did it? It was more like 30.
You don't know what that 4267 is for. It could have been paint or peat moss. You know how you are in a hardware store.
Yeah, but I know I bought the ladder there, though. I could call them tomorrow. Maybe they could trace it back. Look through old records, see if one of the employees remembers.
Heaven's sakes, 10 years ago?
I know, that's my ladder.
Maybe you should just call Perry Mason.
Who? Oh, very funny.
Well, I don't think it's funny. Our dinner is stone cold. You made a mess of the attic up there, and I spent a week cleaning it. Now you're about to break up a 10-year friendship over a crummy ladder.
It's not a crummy ladder. It's a good, solid aluminum extension ladder. And it's mine, not Fred's.
Could we have dinner now? Come on, now, let's go out to the kitchen. I'll heat up everything again.
I don't understand, Fred.
Well, I don't understand you. Don't you understand that Fred only brought up this ladder business, really, because you hurt his feelings when you played tennis today with Bill Fraley instead of Fred?
I think that's pretty childish.
Fred would give you the shirt off his back.
I don't want the shirt off his back. I want my ladder.
Fred's very touchy, but you're very stubborn, honey. Now, why can't you be big enough to let Fred think it's his ladder? You both use it. Even if it cost $100, what price friendship?
Well, it's the principle.
Oh, the principle.
Yeah.
You and Fred squabbling over a ladder. And we wonder why the Arabs and the Jews can't kiss and make up.
Well, now, look, I didn't start all this.
Well, you finish it, then, because I'm friends with Evie, and I cannot cope with a situation where I have to remember you're not speaking to her husband and he's not speaking to you. It just takes too much out of me to remember I'm mad at somebody. Now, I simply... Now that I've got dinner hot again, there's somebody else dropping over. Must be Mrs. Harper. Come in! She's stopping by to pick some clothes for the rummage sale. Mrs. Harper!
Nope, not Mrs. Harper. Me.
Oh. Hi, Fred.
Hi.
Hi.
About the ladder. Evie says she's sure it's yours. I was wrong.
Oh. Well, frankly, Fred...
We had just decided we were wrong and that it is your ladder, Fred, didn't we, dear?
Yeah.
Actually, I said if there's any question, why don't you boys give the ladder to Evie and to me? The wives will own the ladder and we will let you both use it. How's that?
Well, that's fine.
Now maybe we can eat dinner. I'll heat it up again.
Oh, you played tennis today, huh?
Yeah. I took your advice, got myself a new racket, but boy, am I rusty.
Having trouble with your backhand?
Backhand, front hand, legs, arms, elbows, and after 3 minutes, I feel I've climbed Mount Everest.
Yeah. What kind of racket did you get?
Oh, come on out to the car. I'll show you.
Oh, good.
I'm getting dinner on, dear.
Why don't I get my racket? We'll volley a bit in the backyard here, huh?
Yeah, let's go over to your place. It's flatter. So many rocks here.
I'm putting dinner on the table, dear. Now, come on now. The lamb patties aren't any good, you know, when they're cold. Dear. Oh, where are you?
I'm showing Fred my new racket.
Well, I'm going to eat dinner.
Yeah, that's fine. You go ahead and eat, dear. I'm just going over to Fred's for a few minutes.
Oh, a few minutes. I don't know why I even try to make him nice dinners.
This is what aerosol hairspray sounds like. This is what Final Net sounds like. The big difference in the way they sound is the big difference in the way they work. Final Net is not an aerosol. It's concentrated to give you a great long-lasting hold. There are no wasteful propellants. That makes it economical, too. 8 ounces of Final Net go as far as 24 ounces of aerosol hairspray. You get a great hold at a great price. Final Net, the first sensible alternative to aerosol hairspray.
The
Little Things in Life has been brought to you by Daytrill, the new non-aspirin pain reliever from Bristol-Myers. This is the Serial Network.
Yeah, that'll just about take care of business for this month. Boy, that went fast. Okay, Luis, your cue. You can come over and get ready. You know the stuff, so I'm not going to tell you anything more. Just come over here and do your thing right after our theme out, okay? So, folks, thanks for being here. I hope you enjoyed this. I kind of enjoyed putting it together, and, well, it's more fun if somebody else enjoys it, too. We'll see. I hope you did. If you did, that's great, and if not, come back again next time. We'll try again. In the meantime, as always, it's good listening, good night, good luck, and after Luis is finished, goodbye.
I love to listen to my radio. Gee, how it thrills me when I hear it go. Someday you'll hear it soon.
Okay, Rotten Rick Spurgeon, thanks a lot. I will take it from here, wrap things up, and shut things down for this week's broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. As usual, if you have any questions, comments, complaints, or maybe even a request or two, please address them via email to mikeamelli@earthlink.net. That's MIKEAMELI@earthlink.net. We will soon be releasing the key and returning the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish, for as long as you wish. But just remember, be nice to one another. On behalf of myself and the rest of the MSS crew, have a great night, a great weekend, and goodbye.